When kids start failing in school, people start pointing fingers. It's the teacher's fault or the parents. It's the kid's fault. It's the culture or the economy or guns in school. If we just could get enough hot lunches or get that curriculum in place and really start doing it, we could teach Johnny to read and teach Jane to do her sums. On this edition of Conversations, a cultural anthropologist whose field work is done in the schoolyard. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Please welcome from the Department of Education at Stanford University, Ray McDermott. Ray, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's fun to be here.
Well, we'll hope to make it so. I want to start off with a two big question and then spend our time together honing it down and looking at it from different parts. Can I reflect you to yourself?
Sure.
A quote here.
It's suddenly less fun.
That's right. In a piece called Failure's Failure with co-authors, you together collectively wrote this. School failure is inevitable in education, in an educational system in which everyone is encouraged to do better than their neighbors. That tells me that failure is a product of how we define success. Yes?
Very much the case, yeah. I learned that actually, that I think that line comes from being a parent and getting a report card. And I sent my kids to school in New York, and they had the kinds of schools where you had to do what you wanted to do. and you also got report cards that were very gentle. And they would basically, they were called effort reports. So if you weren't very good at school but worked very hard, you would do pretty well. Or I'm not quite sure how they worked it out. My kid came home with a 1 to 5 score, and I don't know what 5 is. I don't know what 1 is. But she had mostly 1s and 2s, and it makes a difference which end of the scale it's at. And so I said to her, what is a 1? She said, I don't know, which is means the school was working. The kids weren't being too busy beating each other up, trying to be better than each other. Well, what's 5? I don't know. Who's good at math? Is there anybody who's very good? Carrie Ann's very good at math, my daughter said. What did she get? She got a 1, Dad. So I knew I was safe. I was safe. And the way I found out was to see how my kid was doing relative to other kids, sure. Which means that everybody can't do well. And what we call normal in America is that you've taken a test and done better than half the kids in the country, which means all the half the kids have to fail in the system at all times, which means we've created, a monster in that half the kids are being upset, depressed, this or that, angry, afraid at any point in the system. Till we get, narrowed down to, that small percentage that goes to the right schools and later on runs for office.
Help me with some smaller parts here. If your daughter comes home with a 1 or a 2 in math, doesn't that mean that she has gained mastery over the math rather than mastery over Carrie Ann, her neighbor?
Sometimes it means that, and that's great. And I certainly, we have a habit in this country of pitting excellence against equality, as if the two didn't go together. And
tell me what that means to you.
Well, I'd be real excited if my kid got real good at math and everybody else in the class got real good at math, and if they could figure out how to use math to help us sort out some real good problems in the world, that they could build better bridges and higher buildings and more efficient train systems, etc. And math is great fun. I would like to see everybody involved in doing it. And we have countries in the world where most of the children in the school system are very involved in math up through calculus. Our school system has pushed the search for winners down so low that we have kids essentially dropping out of math by the 4th grade. By 90% of the kids are out by 9th grade. Almost 100% of the minorities are out by 9th grade. Calculus gets much less than 1%. And then after they get into a good school and they take calculus at a place like Stanford, 90% of them get cut from math after that.
get cut out.
Yeah, so 25% of students who go to Stanford say they're going to major in math or physics, and 2.5% graduate. So 90% get cut. So we have, now the strong argument is that the people who are left are superb mathematicians, and I think, hey, that's all the more power to them, that's wonderful. What I'm worried about is a whole lot of people have been cut out arbitrarily, that out of a population of 240 million, we probably have more than a handful of people who could be mathematicians. Kids who get cut out when they're in the fourth grade are getting cut out arbitrarily. Kids who actually, the student freshmen who come to Stanford get cut out arbitrarily. Getting cut out of calculus means that you got into a class with another 200 people and you sat next to a person who had much better preparation. Mm. And it's hard to make up. It's hard to catch up.
Let's spend some time seeing how that works. I don't want to ask you this question this way, but maybe I just have to do that. Why is there so much failure in math? You say it's comparative, but get in there. What's that?
Interesting. Why more math than other subjects?
Mm. We can start there.
Yeah. I think it's because it's real easy to quantify. It's real easy. And it's, of course, the surest fire. It's the hottest ticket that you can get. It's the place where... If you do well, in fact, this is actually a true story. How much math you have is a perfect predictor of how much money you're going to make in the American economy. So if you get through high school math, you're going to do a lot better than someone who stops mm-hmm. after algebra. If you get through calculus, you're going to do a lot better. If you're a math major, you're going to make, I mean, this is all statistical, right? And of course, there are exceptions, lots of exceptions. But if you get through if you're a math major, you're economically in very good shape in this country. So it's one of the places where I think the strongest gates are set up. So a lot of people are pushed out a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. What's happening in elementary school that is that begins to herd certain people towards a subject and certain people towards another, or certain towards failure and certain towards success? And is that the place to start, is it?
Sure, yeah, elementary school's a good place to start. And in fact, it's seventh grade is the real, eighth grade is the real dividing line. When kids start algebra, most are finished. Most of them don't get out of algebra. A whole lot of them don't even get into algebra. Math, I think, is incredibly hard to teach, and we still don't have real good materials for doing it.
Because it's abstract?
Apparently, and also because this is harsh. If I have a, how many reasons can I give? And of course, I can't give all of them, but if I give some, I'm nervous that I'm highlighting some. It turns out most of our teachers are not real excited about math. Huh. And when you go out to schools, if you want to see some really great lessons, you probably don't go to math first. Most of our teachers are products of the school system that has been sorting out mathematicians for a very long time. And it's a little bit, it comes a little bit less easily to everybody's fingertips. It's still done, for the most part, in that skill and drill way that we all learned with. I went to Catholic schools. I had a nun run down the aisle with a very large ruler mm-hmm. and doing my number facts. And it was terrifying, but we learned a lot, actually. There's no one way to do it. But I think we could make math a whole lot more interesting. It could be connected. You know, the history of math, the reason why we have math is that it was such a powerful tool in the world, and kids often come to us and say, why do I have to learn this? And I don't really have good answers for them. Because you can build bridges, that was the example I picked on earlier. So mm-hmm. you can build buildings. I don't want to build buildings, then why do I have to learn this? If we could organize our math so that the curriculum is more tied to actual activities in the world, and if the assessment system was something other than the surefire, what's the right answer to this manipulation. Mm-hmm. I think we'd have a better chance of getting a lot more people into math. But we have, but it would take a reconsideration of everything. Everything is the way it is for a reason. And we'd have to change one thing, we often have to change 5 or 10, 15, right on up to what do we want to do with education in America. And it seems like what we want to do is to make our kids, my kids, successful. That's what everybody's essential issue is. And
everybody wants that about their own kids.
That's right. And every community wants it of their kids. Every school wants it of its kids.
And success is individual, money and status oriented?
Well, in school, it's doing better than others.
Okay.
And just getting under that cut, over that cut line all the time.
Mrs. Ray McDermott, we're talking about success and failure in America's schools, something that he says is predisposed and conscious. His own education took place first in Queens College. He graduated from that university in 1967 with a bachelor's in philosophy and Asian studies, and then went on to Stanford, where he earned his PhD in 1977 in anthropology. I said that he is a cultural anthropologist whose fieldwork is done in the schoolyard. That's true and not true. Let me just cite a couple of intellectual passions, and then we'll stop later on and along the way and take a look at some of the places that have occupied him. His first intellectual passion, he says, is cultural anthropology, the theory and method and data of it, communications analysis and social structure, and then educational and psychological anthropology. He's worked in the United States and Japan and in Ireland doing his studies. On this edition of Conversation, we're taking a look at schools. Sure. I want to ask you to take a look at other places briefly, if you will, so we can get a grip on why our notions about success are unusual notions relative to educational expertise or successfully completed education. What are we doing and what are other places doing?
The easiest comparison is Japan, because they're real different and real the same, and they're real good at school. They produce very little school failure. About 3% of the students don't graduate from high school. We have horrible stories about how they pressure children, and that's true of high school. Prepubertal education in Japan is a fairly delightful thing to participate in. Mm-hmm. More than half their time is spent doing art and gym and music. We are cutting that stuff out of our schools like crazy.
I was going to say, we don't consider that part of rigor here.
That's right, yeah. They run a couple years ahead of us in math scores and a couple other things. They do it as, it's an incredibly competitive society, but they've done a very interesting thing with education. They do that competition later in the school system than we do. We have first graders who are set on each other, trying to read better than each other, and kids who can't do it hide. And we just have wonderfully rich, evocative, painful records, movies that we've made of first graders who spend their whole year, they're only 6 years old, they spend their whole year arranging, not getting caught, not knowing something. Right? Now, we all know how it is to raise a hand in class and not want to be called on, right? So you raise your hand and put your head down, or you know, you scratch the back of your head and keep your hand down. There are kids who do nothing but that, and teachers who spend almost all their time, instead of worrying about how to teach kids, they have to worry about whether the kid is ready, whether the kid is going to be embarrassed. We have this incredible pressure on very little people to look good and to not get caught looking bad, and it takes almost all their time.
I hear you telling me this is about performance, not expertise, not competence.
Not at all. That's right. It's about showing off. Our educational system is very geared to showing off, which is why it can be that we have people with doctorates who, when we talk to them for a couple of minutes, we say, these poor souls, they don't know anything, they're idiots. That you can get through the American university system now being very specialized, having knowledge that's not connected to the world. And sometimes that's okay, you know. If you're doing medieval history, And I want people to be doing medieval history. We need them. We need people to be telling us about Japanese history, medieval European history, anything anybody wants to get it, be expert at. But we also have people at the university who are supposed to be specialists at how to do things in the world. And very often they're disconnected from that world. Our educational system has become so much a tool of sorting people out that it's not a very good tool for helping us get smart about the world.
Sorting people out.
Into successful, unsuccessful, into those who go to the right schools, those who don't, those who get access to money, those who don't, those who make it. Right? What does make it mean? It depends on where you are, of course, and it depends where in the hierarchy you are. But there's a group of people, right? I don't have the exact numbers, but it's something horrible like 2% of the people control 90% of the wealth in this country. That 2% of the people are making it big. And a lot of people start the school system hell-bent on getting into that 2%. Most of them don't make it. About 98% of them don't make it, as a matter of fact. And the 2% who do tend to be the children of the others. So school is an important device for people making connections that get them places. And it's more that than it is a system for teaching us what we need to know.
This is what you mean when you say if we want to reorganize the teaching of math, we have to change the whole system. You're very serious about that word whole,
sure.
Aren't you?
Yeah, why not?
Right.
Well, we got to try. You know, we're not going to do it. But if I'm a third grade teacher and I have some ideas about what's wrong with the whole system, when I go to help my three-year-olds, my third graders, I might do some things differently than if I don't know what's wrong with the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
I might, for example, like most third grade teachers, I might get real upset that Alex or Terrence or whatever can't do the math as well as somebody else, and I might look to their home for a problem. I might get them tested by the psychologist, and there's always a psychologist there to do the testing. I might send them for a neurological. There are hundreds of things I can do to worry about them, and if I do that without worrying about the nature of the whole system, there's a good chance I'm going to hurt that kid if I don't understand where that kid stands in relation to opportunities for everybody else.
Does this mean that all our cultural good intentions about tracking and mainstreaming,
sure,
and gifted and talented and are all ill-conceived?
Well, all's a heavy word.
Yeah, it's pretty big bat,
yeah.
I just threw
I'll
out there.
I'll go with it.
Oh.
given we're having a conversation,
yeah,
I'll go with it. Right now, about 14% of the kids in the country are called some kind of broken, minimally retarded, brain damaged, learning disabled, emotionally disturbed. There's government money for about 14%, and those two numbers have nestled up to each other very nicely. That means extra money comes to school systems for taking care of 14% of the kids as especially broken. There's no way those numbers are accurate.
But this isn't a shell game. I mean, is this not well-intentioned tinkering, even if it's not?
These are nice people working hard, doing nice things with a real phenomenon. I mean, there are kids who are really learning disabled, and there are kids who are, let me take that back, I'm going to take that word right out of my mouth,
right?
Really learning disabled. Let me take out the really.
Okay.
There are kids who, when confronted with a printed page, have a very hard time sorting it out. And a lot of kids are that way before age 9, and some stay that way. The good news is some of those find a second, like a gearbox on a truck. They find a different reading speed. One of the best students I ever had a horrible life, couldn't read at all till he was 18. He found another speed. He reads philosophy books, like turning the pages like this now. I gave him a book in my office one day, a hard book. He had never seen it before. He said, "Oh, this is so good." He's turning pages faster than I can watch. All people, including all learning disabled people, so-called, have special gears. And it should be our job to help find those gears, help get those people to to move ahead. But it's in any first, second, third grade, there are a lot of kids who are going to look a little bit different. And I don't think we really should be calling them learning disabled, but we should be paying attention to the fact that there are lots of different people with lots of different speeds. The neurologists tell us pretty definitely that we shouldn't force children to read before age 9. A lot of kids just aren't ready. Some kids are. Some kids at age 3 start sorting it out. It makes no difference to what they'll read when they're 20. It makes no difference to what they'll know when they're 30 or 40 or 50. Some kids take to it early, some late, like walking. It doesn't make a difference. But in our school systems, we've driven it down and down and down and down, so now kids have to get trained very often to read before they go to school.
This is how we gauge fluency and competence is by saying who got it earliest and
that's right.
and quickest, right?
That's right. Yeah, with the least effort. It's important to put in no effort in the way we think.
Because then I'm gifted.
That's right.
It's natural.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the hardest job for the students, undergraduates at Stanford, and we lived in the dormitories with them for 5 years. We really like students, and every dorm at Stanford has a family or faculty, people who live in with the students, usually a little house next to the dormitory. Their hard job was to do extremely well without trying. So people would have to spend 20, 30 hours in the library hiding from others in order to look smart. And I think that's culturally a crazy goal.
I want to get back to this subject of labeling. We are a differentiating species, I think. We sort each other out that
Absolutely.
Way. We sort things out that way.
Sure.
How do we pay special attention to and deal with a problem, I don't want to say failure, you see, without naming it and getting some sort of special response to it going?
That's perfect. Great question. That's right. How do I get sensitive to each person without hurting them?
Right.
Without
putting the burden of the label on them.
That's
good.
Right.
Yeah.
And even the names don't have to hurt, except if it's inside a system. And this is where I say you always have to know about the whole system. Except if it's inside a system that's well organized to do that hurting. There's almost nothing I can do for a kid who's really a unique learner, unique in the sense that he's having just a real hard time putting the stuff together in the third grade or fourth grade. Fourth grade's the watershed. Make it fourth grade.
What's the difference between fourth and seventh?
Perfect question. I was switching skills.
Right.
For learning how to read, fourth grade is the watershed.
Seventh is
for staying in the math program.
Got it. Go ahead.
And we can move those around. It would take, if we reorganized the curriculum, we could move math up, 2 years. And we can make reading impossible in the first grade if we wanted to. In fact, we're moving in that direction, terrifyingly moving in that direction. Huh. But whatever it is I call, whatever attention I call to a kid, will it get that child help or will it get that child more trouble? And almost always, the more attention I call to a child, the more he's in trouble. And the good people who are going to bring him that trouble, the local counselor, the psychologist with the tests, and those learning disability specialists and whatever, good people really want to help the kid out. But the point is, as soon as you get earmarked, you're in some trouble. If the whole system is about sorting. If the whole system's about educating, we could call people whatever names we like. It wouldn't make any difference. They could continue to move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But if they get isolated, put into special classes, get often they get a different kind of teacher, they get a different kind of curriculum, they get cut off from what they need to perform in the regular tests, et cetera. By the way, the rich don't do this to their children in the same way. Right? The rich, the private schools of Washington and New York City are infinitely more flexible Children have many more choices. And they sometimes get out of hand. There's a wonderful story out of the Dalton School, which is possibly America's fanciest private school. I don't know what their Nobel Prize count is, but I suspect it's way up there. Huh. Someone gave them a lot of money to screen for learning disabilities. By the next year, 37% of the first graders were shown on some set of tests to be at risk.
And they had not been prior? 37% right. had not been?
Right, that's right. Yeah, they had paid no attention to learning disabilities before that. Kids had an average IQ of 132. Now, IQ is not an important thing, but 132 is a very high number. The difference between 132 and 70 is probably very significant. Between 110 and 90, I don't care. But we're getting, probably their family income is, I'll guess for the place, is $300,000-$400,000. There's no way these kids are at risk. They're going to get saved, protected, pushed ahead, tutored, no matter what happens.
So if we took the Dalton School and put it to work in the inner city, we'd probably do fine.
I think a lot of the reforms that we would like to get organized in American public schools are already being done in all the private schools. And have been done there for a long time.
Well, I keep thinking of Pogo. We've met the enemy and he is us.
I think that's true. Yeah.
This is Ray McDermott on this edition of Conversations. Among his writings, among the subjects of his writings are literacy and schooling, relationships between students and teachers and home and community and culture, teaching in multicultural settings. These are his interests in the last decade or so. In the last 4 or 5 years, he's been doing work on mentoring through the email, culture as disability. Also a little dodge over to ancient Greek literacy, I noticed, and the cultural organization of teaching and learning. How we learn and then how we teach, the subjects of Ray McDermott's professional life and of this conversation. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC. We're talking today about schools and education. Well, I guess I want to just put a cap around this last part and to say then, are all the failures, word used advisedly again, within our system because we are approaching it as a sorting exercise? And we're doing this because we kind of can't culturally help ourselves?
Yeah, I think that's a really good description.
And because Dalton School's at the top, they don't have to sort anymore? They can just educate?
That's right. Mm. Now, they get confused now and then. Private schools get confused. Like, they just did this thing with learning disabilities and had all these kids classified. And some new principal came in and pulled the plug on it, said, this is foolishness, and it went away. So they're members of the culture also, and they do a lot of sorting, and particularly if they get pushed, they can get very good at it. But for the most part, students at Stanford have infinitely more freedoms than students at state schools. They can drop courses, they have a lot more freedom to negotiate their transcript.
That's a statement about power, relative
right.
power.
Exactly. And I think if we looked at the whole thing as a political system instead of an educational system, it would be helpful. Or in addition to an educational system.
Can I ask you another big question and then we can go back to parts again? What ramifications do statements like that have for a society that's becoming rapidly more culturally diversified, that is trying to integrate into its educational system different races, ethnicities, women, people with disabilities, people at all ages too, because we've got continuing education questions here. So we've got this big wiggling bag of snakes here. What's the...
Yeah, you ask really good questions. I should come to this show more often. it has horrible implications for all those people trying to produce change. But it's not just for those people. It's the distance between those who have and those who don't is growing colossally. The middle class is emptying out in two directions, a small number going into the rich pile and the rest are rumbling down into the poor pile. The numbers of people called poor continue to rise. We have 1 million people in jail at the present time, another 2 million who have been in jail, probably another 5 million who will be in jail. We've increasingly divided this society into two parts, and schools are part of that game. And if we're going to rebuild the middle class, if we're going to have people recover a sense of opportunity and a sense of fairness, something's going to have to change fairly drastically, and the schools will be part of that. Getting schools back to doing education instead of politics would be a really important beginning place.
By politics, you mean?
Ugly politics, sorting.
Sorting.
As different from, and so schools could be doing another kind of politics, namely fighting against the sorting impulses of the society. Good teachers, I think, have always done that. Good teachers basically get inside the room, close the door, and say, these are my kids, don't touch them, get your hands off my kids. Mm-hmm. And they turn it, actually they put their back to children and hold on to their class and to protect them from the forces of the world. Good teachers, I think, have always done that instinctively. And when tests come in from the National Testing Services, they worry for the children. When sorting moments like going into the next school, what kind of next school will it be? Will they go into vocational school versus an academic track or something? Good teachers have always worried about their children there. I think we have in the schools tremendous resources of people. If we could loosen the system up a little bit, teachers get very excited about helping children to learn instead of yelling at kids to sit down. It's such a nice day when you do the learning, and such a horrible day. Hardest days of my life, I think, were teaching bottom classes in the sixth grade in New York City, and I was inexperienced. Kids knew it. If their job was to make my life miserable, they were the most brilliant children in the world. And they just tore me apart. And they all, in the long run, I did not help them. I think they all got hurt pretty badly by it. They were already pretty far down the road of being called failures. They were real far away from getting back on the track.
Well, let's stay there for a while. What about schools in this nation that are warehousing successive groups of students through rooms that are said to be out of control, through hallways that are said to be dangerous, in neighborhoods that are said to be out of control and life-threatening? How does teaching go on in that environment? How do you get somebody to get to the other end of a book?
Right. Well, you did. Somebody you identified as a child.
Yeah,
I think.
I
and,
did.
A lot of people identify to somebody as a teacher. In fact, neither one of them can help very much unless the whole school goes through a transformation. Often that takes some cooperation with the neighborhood and some way of bringing parents in. I'll give two examples that I know a little bit about. In Milwaukee right now, they've just built four public schools on private school models. One of them is called the Waldorf School, which is the largest private school system in Europe, and there are about 124 in America.
Is that word Waldorf like a hotel?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah,
thanks.
There was a German philosopher by the name of Rudolf Steiner who was called in by the Waldorf tobacco people. Before they had hotels, they had tobacco places
and salads.
Right. And they asked him to organize an educational system for the children of their workers. And he did, and it was interestingly successful. Mm-hmm. So now there's one in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And it's a tough area. There are crack houses across the street. I mean, the whole street across the street, crack houses. It's a dangerous place to walk around. I spent a week in that school last year, and the children of that neighborhood, and children who have parents who are in bad shape economically, children with parents, and being economically in bad shape does not have to be bad for children. It often is, but doesn't have to be. Children with parents who are in bad shape in terms of drugs, in terms of alienation, alcohol, all kinds of things. And these kids would come to this school. I've never seen anything quite like it. Every teacher in the place hugged every child, good morning, got them before, you know, on a one-by-one basis, got them in lines, brought them to the room, shook their hands as they walk into the room. Every child had a handshake. They spent a tremendous amount of time doing art, natural history, things that children are very excited about. The reading levels have skyrocketed in the place. Even though Waldorf people don't try to teach reading very much, they think it shouldn't happen, and they're right, to the third, fourth grade, preferably fourth. Because they're in America, they've tried to speed it up a little bit. Anyway, great things are happening. Kids from bad backgrounds have great potential. And we as a society, if we don't make use of that, we create a monster. Because if the bad backgrounds plus bad schools, we're going to have a million people in jail. Yeah. We're going to have high crime rates. We're going to have... and then if, in fact, you know, on top of all that would work. Bad background, bad school, that would still work if we had jobs for everybody. But in fact, we don't. So we need people who are going to be able to go out and invent jobs. Is that possible? I think so. But you can't ask 18-year-old children from bad homes, bad schools, to go invent jobs.
You know, you're saying these things in the middle of a culture that says you got to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. You shouldn't mollycoddle kids. We can't spend time doing whatever those. This was something that was in the news recently. There were a lot of protests about a program that was going to do midnight basketball for kids who are at risk for drugs and crime.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Yeah.
This is not a culture that likes that. We don't like to. We don't nurture comfortably, I think, at least with our money in our institutions.
Right, and we pay for it. We pay for it very dearly. We can't rely. I think this is fair. We can't rely on everyone in this culture pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps. If we do, we'll have a million people in jail. And the jail budget of California just went ahead of education. Mm-hmm. It costs $40,000 to keep someone in jail a year. It's an insane amount of money. We just passed.
Rather than paying that guy $40,000 to fulfill a social task of some sort, right?
Of course. Yeah. You could pay him $20,000 and save a lot of money. We just passed the three strikes, you're out. There are, at this very time in California, in the country, there are 5,000 inmates over 65. With this new rule, the estimate is there'll be 120,000 of them by the year 2005. 2005. That means, you know, a significant part of our gross national product will be going into the caring of aged, wasted lives. This is totally insane. So we're at the place where we have to make decisions. This election that took place yesterday looks a lot like people making decisions to vote with the pull yourself up by your bootstraps or get the hell out. But there's no way to go. They don't get out. They stay around. They stay around our neighborhoods. It's harder to feel this in Alaska because Alaska allows a person much more room to think that they have some freedoms. I'm talking about physical, spatial room. And some because, you know, so there's a general excitement here about freedom. If you live in a place like New York City, you can only think about the ways in which these chunks of the culture are moving on each other, that they're squeezing each other. Borders are the primary phenomenon. Crossing borders is terrifying. Mm-hmm. We're in a state of war. In New York, murder rate over the last 25 years is six times Belfast. Washington is way ahead of Beirut. both of them are way ahead of Peru, which has been in a state of revolution for 20 years. We are in a massive class, the beginnings of a massive class warfare. And if we go with that language of pull yourself up or hell with you, as a nation, we're going to lose it. We'll have some very successful people and a whole lot of very unsuccessful people who are very angry. Mm-hmm. And if that's what you want.
We got it coming.
I'm afraid so.
Ray McDermott is with us on this edition of Conversations. I said I would mention field work. He's been doing it in the last 20 years in New York City, in Japan, Ireland, and in California. There's an ongoing project in California taking a look at mathematics in schools. We've talked about that a bit today. Mathematics in schools, in research laboratories, and in the marketplace. This also then looks at sorting and how not to sort, right?
Right.
In New York City, the acquisition of literacy in families and literacy in the workplace, also learning disabilities, we've talked a bit about that, and then family and neighborhood dynamics in Dublin, that research in Ireland. This is Conversations. We're taking a look at schools, learning, education, and now the culture. So I want to know how people learn best. Do we pull from Japan or from the Waldorf system and nurture and play with children to encourage them to learn?
For youngsters, under 10, play is the way almost all learning is done. There's not a lot.
And do you mean like the species does it best? Is that getting back to basics?
Yeah. And you know, you can do a lot of curriculum inside play. You can do an awful lot of math with play. I taught my 5-year-old how to play casino, and it's such a great game for learning math. Mm-hmm. We could do a well-structured play. I mean, Americans tend, when they think about play, when they think about preschool play, is put a bunch of children in a place with some swings, and then they do the
pillows.
And they throw sand in each other's face, and they're mean to each other, and they have cliques. It's really horrible stuff. I'm talking about well-organized. The Waldorf stuff is very well-structured. You rarely find a child doing something that's independent of what the rest of the group is doing. I like that a lot. Mm-hmm. I think children really need a lot of structure. They need a lot of places to feel comfortable, a lot of rhythm. And if we did that up to 10 or 11, I think we'd build an infinitely larger literacy and math base than we currently have. I would like to actually push it to 12. I have some crazy ideas also that, that would have us with teenagers doing something quite different in school.
I bet you're going to say community service and work.
Yeah,
huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. Or forest work, getting out, coming to Alaska, for God's sakes, and running your car off the road and pulling it back up and finding out that there's some relationship between effort and accomplishment. It's very hard for people to find that in some chunks of our society and in homes where people are cut out of the employment system and cut out of the education system. It's real hard to put pieces together. And I think it's just insane that 14-year-olds should be, they're all hormonally out of their minds, that they should be sitting in classrooms for that long. I certainly never hated anything that much. But that's on the crazy scale.
Well, not too far from 14. At 18 or 19, many, and I probably would guess less so these days, but I think a good many people left high school saying, I don't know what to do, and spent several years metaphorically on the road until they figured out what college or craft was all about.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's
part of our cultural history. I don't know whether it's part of our current.
No. Speed is of the essence. Getting out as fast as possible.
I want to talk about classroom competition and classroom cooperation. In your writings, you have talked about dividing students off by their abilities, which you feel doesn't work at all well, and then making them compete for a small gold ring, and then comparing with someplace like Russia, where you say students don't compete but cooperate in gaining of understanding, so that by the end of the fill-in-the-blank day or month or semester, everybody knows what geography is together.
I don't think I used the Russia example because I have no idea what happens there.
Oh, all right.
Usually I pick Japan.
It might have been one of your co-authors.
Could be. Oh, yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did have a Russian page in one of those papers.
I remember.
That's right.
Right. Well, if you're more familiar with Japan, what I'm interested in is where cooperative learning is what you feel is the higher good here for education.
Oh,
why
it's
is that so?
Probably the case. I love competition too. I mean, along with dividing things up into, you know, good and bad and fast and slow and smart and dumb, another division that will probably hurt us is cooperative versus competition. We definitely have too much competition. But the more important thing is we have competition, I think, at the wrong times, or we make competition consequential in the wrong ways, so that we have a lot of competition where a lot of people are invited to stop competing. Right? That's the real danger with competition. When people who are approximately the same on some set of skills get together, competition is a great way to practice. I played basketball growing up.
I was thinking
all
baseball,
the time.
Sure.
Sure, it's a great way. When I was a coach in my old neighborhood for a baseball team, I was 22, so I had 14-year-olds. We had tryouts, and there were probably 200-300 young boys who were eligible for the team in the neighborhood. 16 showed up. And 15 looked at the 16th guy and said, "What are you doing here?"
Already knew.
Of course, everybody knew who was on the team. He had been cut in his third grade, and here he is still coming around with his glove. I wanted so much for this guy to make the team, but he was outside the system. That seems to me. And it was what was the main problem in that neighborhood? Well, there were about 50, 75 young kids who spent their time down in the park smoking and drinking, and a little pre-age drinking, and then, you know, drugs were just beginning to be the thing in the late 60s. So all of a sudden they were smoking other kinds of things, and the police were all over them. And I was so upset, because I didn't know I wasn't a good basketball player until I was about 18 or 19 years old. Adults weren't organizing teams. We played among ourselves. I knew some guys were better, but you know, there was a chance I was going to break through whatever it was. What has happened is, and even this happened in baseball as well as in schools, adults organize little leagues. Then they organize basketball leagues, and now they're all being Jimmy Johnson, trying to win the gold ring or the Super Bowl of 9 and 10 year olds. It's absolutely crazy. And when we bring that model to school, it's very badly designed for whole communities to learn important things together. I don't think we should have a lot of competition, and the Scandinavian countries do this. They don't do tests until age 13. They have almost no learning disabilities, no reading disabilities.
That would scare us to
death. No records. That would make us crazy.
Yeah.
I know.
How do I know whether my kid's better than Carrie Ann?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I don't want you to know, because in fact your kid probably isn't better than Carrie Ann, and Carrie Ann probably isn't better than your kid. Yeah. Somewhere, you know, some very serious decisions have to get made around, maybe it's 15, maybe it's, in my case it was 18. I was failing out of college. I found some ideas that I really wanted to understand, and it was about religion mostly. And I started taking courses on philosophy of religion, and then I found out the Chinese had a very different approach to these things. I started taking courses on Chinese, and I haven't stopped. I'm just so excited about learning things and about books. And I was so lucky not to have been permanently cut out before In fact, my C minus average my first year of college was very close to getting permanently cut out. And I didn't get into graduate schools at first because of that noose around my neck. And it took me a long time to outwork it, but it was possible to do. To do that to 18-year-olds is bad. To do it to 6-year-olds is, it's more than sinful, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. We're going to have so many people locked out of the system that it's dangerous to walk around our cities and other places in the society.
I've given us far too little time. I think we've got 6 or 7 minutes left to kind of ask you what's a parent to do. I think there are probably more students and parents in our listening audience considering continuing education in college than there are teachers or administrators or the like. But if someone is piqued by this discussion, what would you say to that person?
A real important thing is to continue to believe in the school, in the child, no matter what the school is doing to them. I gave a course on special education in New York City. Actually, it was in a labor union of city workers. And most of them had children who were in school in trouble. The course assignment was find a kid who was in trouble and protect them from the school. Don't let them get tested. Don't believe what they say. Confront the system. These are very hard messages. I still get letters. This is 13 years ago. I still get letters from people from that class saying my kid was totally out of control in school. And I kept going up there saying, oh, my child's a sensible child. If he's crazy here, something must be crazy. I don't think it's him. And just I stayed with him. And the people at school was furious with me. The kid did not do any better. But we had a really happy home life. He really was happy that I supported him for about 4 or 5 years. And now he's starting to work hard. He's made a turnaround.
What a long time for a parent to hold his breath or her breath. And
middle class parent. I mean, this is the people I'm talking about were in the working classes, but the reason we have so many things called, so many children getting called learning disabled is because the middle class or upper classes needed a way to talk about their kids who were getting hurt in school.
My kid's a special kid.
Yes.
So, oh, for heaven's
sake. So it doesn't really count that he's not doing well. Uh-huh. And that was the middle class run around the sorting pressures of even the upper class schools. And those kids need a lot of support too. And all of us as parents have to make, well, I had to do this. I've had a couple children, some took to school like ducks to water, and they just walk around thinking all the time. It's just intellectuals. And other kids said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I had to make a choice to be a father or to be the person who was going to yell at the kid 3 hours a night about homework. I tried that often. But ultimately I had to make a decision and say, I think I'm going to hell with school. It's not as important as my relationship to this child. And it's not as important. And this child needs a father when they're going to go through those ages from 13 to 18 when they're asked to kill themselves. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what they're asked to do. First cause of death in America for children. I think if I remember right, it's suicide and murder.
Suicide's first, yeah.
Suicide's now first. It used to not be.
Very frightening.
And murder's way up there. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to tell the difference between suicide and murder in some real important ways. Mm-hmm. Vote with your children. no matter what the trouble is, stay with them, stick with them, make the family come around. Families are a much more important institution than schools. We've been doing family for a million years as a species. We know how to do it, except when conditions are bad and we can really get it screwed up, you know, and you can turn on, you know, Geraldo every day and see, you know, how badly we can get it screwed up. But basically the family that fights the whole system together, stays together.
This whole hour I hear you saying focus on the human being.
Yeah.
And don't waste anybody. Keep
That's
everybody
right.
in the fold.
Focus on in the whole community. Mm-hmm. And within that, focus on persons, but always be thinking about what you need those persons to do in our community. That's the hard part. We're pretty good as a nation at isolating people and worrying about their needs. We're not very good. Schools are real good at this in some ways. But we're not real good at thinking about how those people are going to be fitted back into a community, what the whole community needs from that person.
Oh. Fascinating hour. Thanks, Ray McDermott.
It's a pleasure. Yeah.
This has been Conversations. We've been looking at schools. This man comes to us from Stanford University, where he directs Stanford's teacher education program, Stanford University School of Education, a professor therein since 1989. He's spent some time, about a decade, with Teachers College at Columbia University in the Department of Family and Community Education, and before that in the Laboratory of Comparative Human Cognition at the Rockefeller University. He comes to us from Stanford. You can read his work in academic journals. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thanks again, Ray.
Great.
And I hope you join me again next week.